This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you.
Equity.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. I am very excited for this interview. We haven't spoken to a lot of venture capitalists on this podcast. We mainly focus on public markets. But when the opportunity to speak to one of Australia's best venture capitalists comes along, how can you say no to that?
Well, we can't. And that's why it is our absolute pleasure to welcome Nikki Shevak to the studio. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Nikki is a co-founder and general partner at Blackbird Ventures. They're an Australasian investment firm whose mission is to invest in wild hearts with the wildest ideas right from the beginning. He's also the co-founder of Startmate. So we're going to unpack all things venture capital today with Nikki. But just a reminder before we start, we are not experts, we're not financial professionals, and we are not licensed. So we're here learning just like you, and nothing on this podcast should be taken as advice. So Nikki, we always love to start these interviews with insight into the story of our guest's first investment. So can you take us back to that time and perhaps talk us through the moment when you first got into markets, into, well, whatever your first investment may have been?
I think that was at university. I started university in 1998, and that entryway into technology was through the backdrop of the first internet boom of the turn of the century. And so I think the first interaction with investments I had was through technology companies like Liberty One and eCorp, and I think there was a web design agency called Spike, and these were sort of the I guess the heroes, or at least the bright lights of the original technology boom in Australia at the turn of the century.
I've got to say, not any names that I'm familiar with now. Are any of them kicking along under new names or as acquired companies?
Liberty One and Spike were abject failures, and eCorp was a great success. It was actually founded through Kerry Packer, or James Packer's PBL, and Daniel Petrie, founder of Airtree, and Jeremy Phillips, who went on to grander investing success at Spark Capital, leading their growth team. Incredible people, quality of companies they brought to Australia were eBay Australia and Charles Schwab and Monster, and a whole bunch of sort of iconic internet brands from the US and their set up in Australia. So ECorp was certainly a great success, but not the other two.
Yeah, okay. Now, you said you got interested in technology and started investing at that time. You also founded a company at that time, and would love to hear about your experience as a founder before we turn to your experience as an investor. So I believe Bookmarkbox was the company back then. And then more recently, although still a little while ago, Home Thinking, I believe, was the other company. Tell us about your time as a founder in those two companies.
Yeah, well, the Bookmarkbox was more famous for the person I did it with rather than what it achieved itself. So I went to university. In my university course, I was fortunate enough to do the course with Mike Cannon-Brookes, who is a founder of Atlassian. Scott Farquhar was also in the same cohort, as well as a whole bunch of great people who went on to entrepreneurial endeavors. The story of the Bookmarkbox, I would say, was I always like to say that the Bookmarkbox was my university degree. So I met a whole bunch of wonderful people at university, but I learned so much more through the journey of the Bookmarkbox, which, you know, he raised a little bit of money from Mike's dad and my uncle and another angel. We built the service to, I think it was nearly 100,000 users and millions of bookmarks. And Bookmarkbox is basically a way for you to manage and share your bookmarks online when people use different computers as they went from home to work or to school and in between. And so it was a great learning exercise around customer acquisition, around product engagement and product roadmaps. And we ended up selling the company. Even a funny story there was the company that bought it. And again, these are all tiny amounts of money, tiny angel round, tiny exit. But the people who bought it went on to build DoubleClick, which is the backbone of Google's ad serving system. One of the other companies that was a competitor to the Bookmarkbox was Elon Musk's brother. So we got to interact with him through that process as well. And so this was all, again, just a set of experiences that summed up to, I would say, 100 times the learning I got through the textbooks and the classroom of my, you know, real university degree.
That's awesome. In footy, we often speak about the years that produce like an awesome draft, and it sounds like the year at your university was jam-packed with some amazing
business. And I would even say that particular course, which is business information technology, it's kind of half commerce, half computer science, produced wonderful, like year after year, entrepreneurs. Brad Lindenberg, founder of QuadPay, which was acquired by Zip, many other, you know, great startup success stories from both our year and then you know, the years before and after as well. So it was a fountain of entrepreneurial activity, even though it had nothing to do with entrepreneurship.
So it's every young entrepreneur's dream to have an exit during university. You then went on to do Home Thinking. Was it as successful as Bookmarkbox?
Well, I'd say both were not successful. So to calibrate,
okay,
they were. Bookmarkbox was tiny. Home Thinking, we raised an angel round. It ultimately did not succeed for Home Thinking's fortunes. So Home Thinking was essentially we would crawl all of the real estate activity in the United States to notice which agent sold the most homes for the best prices in the quickest amount of time. And sort of when you were thinking of selling your own home, you could search and make this decision as to who to hire as your real estate agent in a very kind of data-driven way. And so in the beginning, this was 2005, the company had success in sort of driving traffic and usage through organic search. And so for a while it was successful. And then as sort of the tides of the Google algorithm changed, it sort of steadily was chopped down and ultimately didn't find another way to acquire customers. And so that company did not work out, but again, a set of experiences that helped me both appreciate sort of online businesses, customer acquisition, and business models on the web. And so, you know, both the Bookmarkbox and Home Thinking featured very heavily informing my views on what is a good business and what is not a good business.
The really privileged thing that we, Bryce and I, have here is that we've had so many conversations with so many different people, and you can really start to draw parallels, or like you can link different conversations. And you talking about how you were having initial success and then Google changed their algorithm, or things changed with Google, and all of a sudden the whole business was put in jeopardy, just gave me massive deja vu to when we spoke to Finder's founder, Fred Shabaster, where he had exactly the same thing. Early success, Google tweaked their algorithm, and then all of a sudden the business was had to be rebuilt from the ground up. It's just a really real reminder, I guess, and we probably don't need this reminder of just how powerful Google is. But anyway, Nikki, so you started a few businesses. I think if you exit, that's successful. So I don't think you can sell yourself short and say Bookmark Box wasn't a success. But then in the early 2010s, you start two things which I don't think anyone will dispute was successful, or co-founded two things that have been very successful, Startmate and Blackbird. I want you to take us back to that time, 2010. You've just wrapped up your second business, HomeThinking. What gave you the confidence to think, all right, I can start Australia's like first founder mentoring and education community in Startmate, and I can become a VC? Take us back to that time and tell us the story.
Yes. So as I mentioned with HomeThinking, it was for the US, and I was I'd moved over to New York, I think, at the end of 2003. And so I was living in America. I was traveling quite often to San Francisco. Around that 2005 period, there were a kind of wave of startups that, you know, was called Web 2.0 or user-generated content, or the sort of different monikers. But through that, got to know a lot of the, say, early, like the founders of Yelp, the founders of Trulia and Zillow, and a whole bunch of other sort of Web 2.0 startups and founders. So had that experience. Moved back to Australia around 2010 to get married, to have kids. It was very personally driven rather than work driven. And as I moved back to Australia, the people that I was meeting here were just as good as the people I was meeting in San Francisco or I was meeting in New York. So that was sort of the first realization. Then Mike and I are still great friends, and I'd followed the journey of Atlassian and how he and Scott had built the company over the years. And again, that is a truly pioneering company, particularly around the unique philosophy around sales and marketing that has driven the company to the success it has become. And so I always had a love of investing, and I think people think of investing as spreadsheets, whereas I think of investing as psychology. It's such a interesting game or environment to test psychology, whether it's your own psychology, whether it's the psychology of the people that are building great companies. And so had always loved Charlie Munger. He's my favorite person and biggest investor influence. Warren Buffett, would read everything I could ever get my hands on, whether directly through the annual letters or through the many different books written about him or articles online written about him. I'd always like read hedge fund letters. I think, you know, they're some of the best examples of writing and clarity of thinking. And I'd always enjoyed just even reading those for fun, even though I didn't really have any money to invest in the public markets or in startups. And so that investing gene had always been there, and I'd always personally, you know, read and learnt and listened around the craft of investing. And so when I came back to Australia, I was thinking, should I do another startup? And I was exploring some different ideas around it was sort of like a conversion marketing software where you do A/B testing, and you would also have this marketplace of people to help you run a steady diet of A/B tests. So I was doing that, but I also had this itch of, again, I'd met people that were just as good as the people I'd got to know in America, and wanted to begin angel investing. And so I had the budget for, say, one or two investments per year of 25K each, and began meeting companies in Australia, and realized, first of all, 25K is not going to bring a round together or make much difference. And even investing one or two companies per year, that's going to limit the learning I can sort of glean. And so that led to Startmate, which led to this batch model of investing and batch model of learning as I thought about it as to how to become a great angel investor. And so that was the prompt for Startmate. Also, the big difference in Australia at that time was in America and in Silicon Valley, the magic is when someone who builds a technology company helps and invests in the next generation. And that was largely absent in Australia. You had very successful companies, but they're all very disconnected, and there wasn't that same circle of life or founders helping other founders. And so the two prompts for StartMate was I could learn a lot more quickly and make a lot more investments per year as the selfish reason. And then the sort of what the market needed reason was assembling this community of founders to help the next generation. And so that initially was StartMate. StartMate wasn't, I didn't imagine it would be a full-time job, or I didn't imagine it would be a career. But as soon as I did it, and as soon as we completed the first cohort and the second cohort, it was just so clear, this is what I wanted to do. To contrast it with Home Thinking, which served real estate agents, if I ran into one of the customers on the street, I'd kind of duck into the side alley. Versus if you ran into one of the customers of StartMate, I would run towards them and, you know, embrace them with a hug. It was that difference of just truly, you know, even on the level of like you make friends in waves, and you make a wave of friends in high school, you make a wave of friends in university, you don't really make a wave of friends after that. With StartMate, I genuinely made a wave of friends, both in the startup founders that we invested in and the mentor community. As part of StartMate. So that was a realization moment or a light bulb moment for me of like, this is actually what I want to do in life. And also success slaps you in the face. If you're launching something in business and you're kind of, you know, reading the tea leaves, or you're sifting through the gold pan and you're not quite sure, it's like, you know, the saying, if you walk into a shop and you have to ask the price of a good, you can't afford it. If you have to look for product market fit, you don't have it. And so with StartMate, just right from the beginning, it was just so clear, both from all of the wonderful pipeline of people who should be doing startups, from mentor interest in investing and helping the next generation, the initial success of the companies that we invested in, it was all slap you in the face, obvious that this was something that was truly needed. And so I think around that time, I was like, why am I thinking of doing another company? Why am I spending time on sort of like this software idea when this is the greatest opportunity? This is the greatest imbalance between opportunity and who's looking at it. And so that was the personal prompt around bringing Blackbird and teaming up with Rick Baker and teaming up with Bill Barty to begin Blackbird. And that moment was, for me, let's try to make an impact through investing and helping startups to come from Australia and New Zealand and to win this kind of global prize, rather than startups at the time had been very sort of locally focused, take a good idea from the US and make it work in Australia. And the mission of Blackbird is, can we produce these world champion generational companies from Australia and New Zealand, and to do everything we can to set up the environment for that to happen at a lot higher rate than what it was doing.
Mm. Well, Nikki, we're about to unpack the mission and your investment framework at Blackbird in a bit, but I thought we should just mention that we personally know a number of people that have gone through the StartMate program and speak incredibly highly of it. So, just thought we'd pass that on and would certainly recommend it to any, well, not that we've done it, but based on the feedback, it sounds like it's absolutely worthwhile.
It is a magical community.
Yeah. So, Nikki, let's start with the name Blackbird before we dig into the thesis and wild ideas. What does it mean? Does it have any meaning behind it? Startups is probably, name is one of the first thing founders do. Put an IO at the end, put a Lee at the end.
Drop a vowel,
change the spelling. How did Blackbird come about?
The name Blackbird references the Blackbird fighter jet that was developed by Lockheed Martin. And before Lockheed Martin developed the Blackbird plane, it had spent in the order of tens of billions of dollars, built a team of thousands of people to design the world's fastest fighter jet. And they'd failed, it'd run over, it cost much more than they thought. And there were a small group of people within that team that said, you know, screw this, this is ridiculous, let's break away. The Skunk Works project that's initially references the Blackbird fighter jet, and this small team ended up building the world's fastest plane, and I think it still is the world's fastest plane. This was developed back in the 70s, and so I think it's this idea that small teams achieve things that big teams don't. Like, why in business do all of the world's biggest corporations, with the customer relationships, already the revenue streams of an existing product, have a front row seat into what's next in the future of whatever their industry is? Why do they screw it up? The innovator's dilemma, and so on and so forth. Why does like a team of nobodies who have no money and very few resources. Why does that team consistently win time after time in history? You know, Fairfax lost the opportunity to seek in realestate.com.au and car sales and so on. Why does that happen time and time again? And I think it is, small teams beat big teams. Small teams don't have middle management. I think middle management kills the creation of something. Middle management is useful in optimizing something to take something that you already know is true and to try and make it work on the bigger scale, but suffocates sort of the creation of new things. And then also I think the constraint of the fear of death produces these great moments and these great conceptions of businesses. And so the startups, which stare death in the face every 12 or 18 months, is a much greater motivator. And then when they do succeed, they're succeeded. The level of success is on the founders and employees all become extremely wealthy. Versus in the big company, if something fails, which it normally does, the person might be fired. If something succeeds, nothing really changes. They don't really get the fruits of that success. And so there's not that same fear of death. And there's almost to the opposite, it's sort of a failure minimization environment. There's no reward for success. And so I think the structural makeup of startups mean that despite all of the advantages, strategic advantages you could ever want, a small team always beats a big team. And so I think we love that idea. The idea is reflected through the name Blackbird.
I love that story behind the name. Now I feel that we need a better story behind our name. I'm feeling very inadequate about it.
And the second test was it had to be pronounced correctly by a three-year-old. Could you say it as a three-year-old? And then if you heard it, could you spell it automatically, to your earlier point around the no vowels and L-Y and so on. So if you said it over the phone or over a video call, you have to naturally be able to spell it as well.
Nice. So, Nikki, then that leads us into your investment philosophy, because you've had some great successes with some of the companies you've invested in at Blackbird. But before we get to the specifics, it would be great to just understand 2012, you and your co-founders are starting it. What's the investment thesis? What companies are you looking to invest in? And I know in previous interviews, you've spoken about maybe the silliness, maybe that's not the right word, but the silliness of the round structure that a lot of VCs fall into. Was that a thesis you had at the time, or is that something you developed over time? Just give us an idea of how you think about investing in early stage companies.
Yeah, first of all, I don't think at the beginning we had a strong view. That strong view emerged after we began investing. And the first fund of Blackbird was a $29 million vehicle, which basically means you can only invest in the first round of a company because you don't have enough money to invest in the next rounds. But the world of venture capital is strangely structured around the round of financing. What I mean is, like, you have these seed funds that invest in the seed round, and then you have a growth fund that invests in growth rounds, and you have venture capitalists that only invest if it's private, and if it goes public, something magical happens to the company, and those people who invested in the private markets have no qualifications to invest in it afterwards. So you have to wrap up your involvement with the company, and the public markets person who's in the whatever asset, you know, threshold bucket of the small cap fund, that person's the most qualified to invest in the company now. And then if that person makes a good decision and the company succeeds and it gets bigger than the small cap threshold, then the mid cap person and then the large cap. And so it's just this silly way that the investment world has structured itself. And it is a byproduct. Why is that the case? It's a byproduct of the people that give money to investment funds. So every institutional investor follows exactly the same model of investing, which is the portfolio allocation model. And they divide their portfolio into buckets, and they want to have X percent in bucket A and Y percent in bucket B. And it's sort of like a bucket way of viewing the world, which doesn't make sense, because if you think about it through that lens of, like, the person who meets the small cap manager who meets the company in a hotel room for the pre-IPO roadshow, meets them over two meetings, that person is way more qualified, and the venture capitalist who's known them for 10 years and has developed all of the context of the market and the product and the team and how the founders run the company and that falls away. That doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense for a seed fund to invest in a company when it's an idea, so before revenue, before product, and you see the company succeed. And then you're saying by only investing in the seed round, it's like, well, I would like to invest in a company before they're successful. And as soon as I know they're successful, I'll proudly not invest in them, which again, that doesn't make sense to me. So I think we've reoriented Blackbird around the concept of company relationships rather than particular staged investments. And the vision, you mentioned Australian venture capitalist, and we don't want to be the best Australian venture capitalist. First of all, that's a tallest dwarf contest. We want to be the best in the world, not the best in Australia. But you also don't want to be a venture capitalist. We don't want to invest at the early stage, full stop. The aim of Blackbird is to invest in these generational companies right at the beginning, before they have product and before they have revenue, but invest all through their life and both through their private market life and their public market life. The idea behind Blackbird is that Australia and New Zealand will produce more than our fair share of generational companies. Generational companies end up as the world's largest companies. If you look in the US, most of the top 10 are technology companies. The top two companies, Alibaba and Tencent, are the largest companies in China. And that same phenomenon will happen in Australia over the coming decade, or at least that's what we believe. And so we want to invest in the very, very best companies right at the beginning, be the major investor partner to them, and to figure out a way, we're not structured to do this currently, but to invest not only through their first decade of their life, venture capital funds are sort of 10-year vehicles, but to figure out how we can own these generational companies beyond their first decade.
Now, Nikki, before we turn to actually unpacking what a generational company looks like, we're just going to take a very quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So you mentioned there you like getting in and investing in the very, very best companies right at the start of their journey. Can you perhaps explain to the Equity Mates community, if possible, like what does a generational company look like? What is the sort of key common traits that you see sort of form in the early stages of these companies?
It comes down to, I think, ambition and a sense of responsibility to see that vision come true in a big way over many, many decades. And so I think at the beginning, you can only detect it through the ambitions of the idea and the impact it hopes to make. I think at the end, it's very clear that something is a generational company, something like Amazon or Microsoft or Google. It's very clear that they've completely reshaped the way that the world does something, or the way that the consumers spend their personal lives, or the way that people spend their working lives, has this large impact on the world, has a product roadmap that lasts many decades. Again, a faux pas or a sort of turnoff is if someone comes to us and says, hey, here's our exit strategy. Like, why would you want to almost like plan your divorce from your relationship between you and the idea? I think the sort of truly interesting business stories are where that person is doing their life's work. It's both useful in the beginning, when it's usually in the beginning, it doesn't go right straight away. And so that sense of doing their life's work gets them through that early tough period. But more importantly, when it's clear that something is working, it provides a defense barrier against exiting too early. So the only way that you'll get to a $100 billion company is if you have a really successful business. Again, that is the very, very rare thing, the 99% thing. But in the 1%, so you've got a successful business and you're in that situation, that 1% of companies, you need that person to be almost irrationally rejecting acquisition offers. You have to say no at $100 million. You have to say no at $1 billion. You have to say no, you know, the Facebook movie, and even in real life where Yahoo almost acquired Facebook for $1 billion. And the way in which Mark Zuckerberg considered that offer, why would we even talk about it? It clearly doesn't take into account, you know, his sort of multi-decade vision of what is to come, or dramatically undervalues the company's long-term prospects. But in the short term, in the moment, $1 billion looked incredibly generous. But that person and their life's work and their mind is so far in the future. And so to get to $100 billion or more, you need that person to say no to acquisition offers along the way. And really the only credible and predictable and authentic way that happens is if that person is doing their life's work and does have that product roadmap in their head that is like itching to get out, and it takes decades to come to fruition.
Well, Nicky, let's turn to some of the companies that you've invested in, because Blackbird, you look for wild hearts and wild ideas, and you have been pitched some incredibly wild ideas that have gone on to be successful. So I think Canva is the big name in your portfolio. In hindsight, not that wild an idea, just an incredible business and one that has made even Bryce and I designers. So kudos to the whole team there. But another company that people may not be familiar with, but is a pretty wild idea, Zoox, Z-O-O-X, since been acquired by Amazon, but a self-driving car startup from the very early days. When you get pitched an idea like self-driving cars very early, how do you even go about forming an investment thesis or like assessing the probability and likelihood of this business succeeding?
Mm. Well, so first of all, is it fresh? Is it unique? And certainly back in 2014 when we met Tim Kentley Clay, who was founder and CEO of Zoox, is that sort of idea fresh and unique? Again, it's almost sort of one of the most common questions I get asked is like, oh, what categories of investment are you interested in? And sort of venture capital is actually, well, at least seed round investing is anti-category. You don't want there to be a category. You don't, the prototypical example of Airbnb was weird. There was no on-demand economy. There was no category for it to fit through when the seed investment of Airbnb happened. As Airbnb succeeded and as Uber succeeded, there became the category and there became this sort of comfort in investing in a category. Like even Airbnb having someone stay in your house that you didn't know, or Uber having someone hop in a car with a stranger. These were like strange sort of ideas in the beginning that quickly become mainstream as they succeed. And so you want something to be quite strange in the beginning. Then I would also say, what is a good idea? Everything is a good idea at a high level. But sort of the definition for good ideas in my mind is the second meeting better than the first meeting? Is the third meeting better than the second meeting? Does the idea become better as the founder describes it in more detail? Usually it's a facade. Usually it's like, hey, we're blockchain for, I don't know, some other category. And then you're like, well, what does that mean? And as soon as you go to the second step, as soon as you go to the detail, it just completely falls away. And so it's this facade that has nothing behind it versus the great ideas. The level of detail in which the founders have thought through the product and the system around it, like that's the exciting thing, is as you go deeper, do you get more and more excited? And with Zoox, obviously it's a very hard technical challenge. How do you have a car drive itself? But the insight or the vision for Zoox was not technology driven. It was to not only have the responsibility of the software, but to have the imagination to take the responsibility for the hardware that you would, if you could build something from the ground up, could you create something that is truly different, that is more a living room on wheels rather than a car that drives itself. And then the ultimate expression of the business being a consumer service. So Zoox being a service where you have the Zoox app, you press the button, the Zoox vehicle picks you up and takes you to your destination. The responsibility to do the software, the hardware, and the consumer service, but also the reasons why you would want to do that. Again, to have the fresh user experience, you need to imagine the vehicle from the ground up. But also, if you're going to run a taxi service, you need the vehicle to run 16 hours a day, and so you need a huge battery in the vehicle. You need to optimize it to be run in a fleet, and so in terms of how can you repair them quickly, think Formula One pit stop versus like going to your suburban garage and custom parts and ordering and a thousand different things. And so the business model of a robo-taxi service, so self-driving cars, you might think, oh, why wouldn't you sell the car? Like, you can buy a Tesla. But if you think about it from an economic point of view, you buy a Tesla for $100,000, Tesla makes sort of 20, 25 grand gross profit. And that's like a one-off transaction. You buy the car, that's it, one revenue event. Versus if you operate a robo-taxi service, still costs, and it's going to cost you more to make the car because it's driving itself. But that robo-taxi is earning revenue every single day. It can earn hundreds of thousands of dollars per year for many, many years. Hopefully the vehicle can be in service for 5 years, 7 years, 8 years, whatever it might be. And so it's not just like a little bit more lucrative, it's like 100x more lucrative. And so to know that if you have the most lucrative version of the business model, you can get to market quicker. Again, the vehicles are very, very expensive. Doesn't cost 50 or 70 grand to make. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to make. Well, if you're operating a robo-taxi, you can still make your money back within a year. And so you can launch, well, all of the robo-taxi providers thought they could launch in the last year or two. That hasn't happened. But, you can now hail a robo-taxi in San Francisco with Cruise. You can hail a robo-taxi in Phoenix with Waymo. And then Zoox have sort of hinted they're very, very imminently launching their own commercial service as well. So it was 2 years late. But again, the choice of robo-taxi as a business model, those three companies, which were not automakers, Cruise was acquired by GM, so I guess that could be twisted to say, yes, it was an existing automaker. But again, these small teams that had no automotive experience are going to be the first ones to bring this technology into the world. The business of earning hundreds of thousands of dollars per robo-taxi is a lot more lucrative than selling $20,000 Toyota Corollas. And so I think the automotive industry as a whole will be reshaped as the transport industry. And then also just you think about electric vehicles replacing petrol vehicles, but you think about robo-taxis replacing people who own their own cars. Most of the time your car sits in your driveway or parked, and I think the utilization is essentially like 2% of the time you're driving your car every day. Versus a robo-taxi, if you can have the robo-taxi in utilization, say 50 or 60% of the day in paid commercial rides, for every robo-taxi, that's taking 30 cars off the road. So you automatically, in terms of like electric vehicles replacing petrol vehicles, you're taking 30 petrol vehicles off the road with every robo-taxi that is utilized to 50 to 60%. And so again, just so many aspects of the idea, so many ways in which they'd thought through both why it was possible for a car to drive itself, what the user experience or the consumer experience of the vehicle might be, the business model of a robo-taxi versus selling the vehicle. Like, it was just enthralling, and it was just so interesting and so fresh. And so that's what you look for in the beginning. You don't try to think, is it likely or not? You just try to think, does it have a chance or not? In the beginning, and we've published our initial investment note on Zoox, we said it's going to take a long time and they're going to have to raise a huge amount of money. It's completely illegal for a car to drive itself. Back in 2014, it was. And they're going to have to compete against all the world's largest automotive makers, Volkswagen, as well as all of the world's largest technology companies like Google and Uber and so on. And so those three things are quite daunting. Those three things logically make it a low probability, but you're just looking for some probability. You're not looking for a likely probability. The other aspect is in the venture capital business, the money is invested over time. And so in the case of Zoox, our first investment was $500,000 in that first seed round of the company, but we ended up investing more than $100 million just into Zoox as they progressed, as it became clear that it was legal to drive for a car to drive itself on public roads, that it became clear as to how Zooks would raise the capital it needed to, how the sort of technical progress and the progress of the company overall was a very, very special. It was one of the best teams in the world alongside Google and Cruise. And so as that information became clear, that's when you invest larger and larger amounts. Similarly with even Canva, first investment was $250,000. We've invested $270 million just into Canva. So the first investment was 0.1% of our total investment. So if you thought about it as in the successful case, I'm going to invest 0.1% of my total investment in this round. Again, you won't trip yourself up mentally too much to say, the question is actually, are they asking the right questions and does it have a chance, rather than do they have the answers and has it been proven, kind of, mental traps that you can fall into.
Mm. Yeah. So Nikki, what would be the wildest idea that you've actually put money into?
Mm. Well, I would say Zooks would be right up there. And Zooks was sold to Amazon in 2020 for more than $1 billion. But it's still a company that I think about every single day.
I was going to ask, are you annoyed that they sold? Like, did you see bigger things and that you think they sold too early?
We made money on our investments, and Amazon, with one of the biggest balance sheets in the world, by owning Zooks, makes Zooks much more likely to come into the world and much more likely to succeed. So from the idea of Zooks coming into the world, Amazon's acquisition makes it much more likely. So there's no taking away from that aspect. But from a personal or at least a career standpoint, it is a company I still think about every single day. And I think it is such a great example of ambition, such a great example of first principles thinking, such a great example of taking the responsibility to see something come into the world. It's not like a piece of the puzzle, it is the puzzle. And I think over the coming years, in particular, Zooks has a chance to be a generational company. Even with the stock market as it is, Amazon isn't really Amazon anymore. Amazon is 90% of the value of Amazon stock is AWS, and the retail operations and everything that people know about Amazon is essentially valued at zero. And I think Zooks has the chance, if you had to fast forward a decade, has a chance to do the same thing to the, AWS is a rounding error of Amazon, and Zooks is the value. Again, not likely.
I love that, Nikki. I love that.
Not likely and not probable, but a probability of some sort, given just the economics of the service at full scale.
Mm. Now, Nikki, we are running short on time, but I have to ask you a question about valuations, because valuations in 2021 and valuations in 2022 are completely different in public markets and in venture capital and private markets. So my question is, were we wrong then? Are we wrong now? Or is it both?
I was going to say we're always wrong. Whatever year you pick, there is never a chance that valuations will be precisely correct. 2021 was 100% wrong. Equally, though, you think back to 2012 or 2011, was $2 million pre-money the right seed round price for Airbnb? $2 million pre-money for Instagram, was that the right pre-money? YouTube, I think, raised it at a $3 million valuation. So knowing what you know now about the, Instagram as a public company would be worth $100-200 billion if it was an independent public company. YouTube would be worth $100-200 billion as an independent public company. Was that correct? And I think that's categorically no. Knowing how many startups got started in that year, so the universe of ideas, knowing the probabilities of success, I think people correctly estimate that it's very low probability and of working out. But I think what people underestimated was the scale of the success when it does work out. Again, they were imagining that it might be worth $5 billion or $10 billion, not $500 billion. And so I think people were wrong about that. Equally, 2021, it was not only people drunk on vodka, it was the vodka mixed with Red Bull. And not only was it Red Bull vodka, but it was intravenously connected to people's veins rather than orally ingested. And so for sure, last year was wrong, but I think of it as technology startups and technology companies. The world is still figuring it out. The world, again, to think that valuation is a settled science, that's where you can make the mistakes. When you think of valuation as a constant experiment or a constant process that is being added to and improved upon, like, it's embarrassing what, you know, we teach university people about finance and that it's an efficient market, and then use DCF. They're two of the worst ideas. Just to think the human race has not figured out valuation in business, and we are constantly trying to add to our knowledge and to experiment with what is the signals to pay attention to. Also, just even like the accounting system was invented when things were very asset driven, and so very heavy industry asset driven, versus all of the value increase in the world's business, you know, enterprise value is intangibly driven. It's non-asset, it's knowledge, it's how do you think that, you know, Google's product spend is an expense and not an asset. When some company gets acquired, that knowledge or the operating expense becomes an asset as on the balance sheet. So again, I just think if we think we don't know, and we're coming from that place and trying to work out, the world is just in this wrestling match with how to correctly value companies, and especially technology companies, and especially at the early stages, these are all the margins of error exponentially increase as you smash these things together.
Mm. We're always wrong, but that's what creates the opportunity. And Nikki, we could have spoken for another hour. There's so much more we'd love to unpack. So we'll have to do this again, but we are running out of time, and we always do like to finish with the same three questions. So we'll move on to those. The first, do you have any books that you consider must read?
I always give Poor Charlie's Almanac to anyone, you know, whether they join Blackbird or I meet. It's my absolute favorite book in the world. And I think I took two things out of it, that investing is more psychology than spreadsheets. Again, people think of investing, you're doing spreadsheets and you have three decimal precision, and you can, this fantasy that you can forecast out precisely 10 years ahead. That is a theatrical version of investing that has nothing to do with reality, versus the psychology of investors at different times, when, you know, at the extremes of when things go well and at the extremes when things don't go well, and what governs that psychology in those extreme moments. And then also the second incredible idea is you can take lessons from other disciplines and other industries and apply it to investing. And whether that's through how general society works, how biology works, everyone should check out the Santa Fe Institute, which is a sort of interesting university in America that looks at these sort of complex systems and how they all interact. And investing is one complex system, but yeah, I don't know how ant colonies are another complex system, and how they work and the dynamics that govern them and so on are another. And what can we learn from those other systems and apply it to the investing system? So I think that book was so transformational in my life that it's singularly the best recommendation.
Now, the second question, forget valuations, forget this company as an investment idea, and just purely on what the company is, what it does, and who runs it. What's the best company you've ever come across?
Mm. That is a difficult one, because there are many different candidates.
Yeah, I feel for you more than most. This might be like picking between children with all the companies that you've invested in.
Companies that we have already invested in, is that?
Oh, no, I just mean generally in the whole universe, but I feel like, you know, it might be easier for a public market investor who's abstractly looking at spreadsheets than you who so.
I would say it's Amazon, but because of AWS, I think AWS is the most beautiful business in the world. And again, in a decade's time, will be the largest company in the world. It may be still inside Amazon, it may be still called Amazon, but AWS is the most beautiful business.
Nice, love that. At least until Zooks makes it a rounding error on Amazon's balance sheet. All right, well, Nikki, we've absolutely loved this conversation. Bryce and I, as we're going, we keep notes in the Google Sheet, and we've got a big paragraph of notes and quotes from you today. So it's been a great conversation, and one that we hope we can do again. But final question, if you think back to your younger self at university in that cohort of future founders, starting that first company and getting interested in tech, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Go directly to what you want to do in life. I think I was victim to this, and I see so many young people delude themselves into thinking that, you know, where they want to get to, you need seven different steps and some winding maze to get to it. Oh, I need to join a consulting banking job for 2 years to hate it and leave and to do something else. And everyone who does that, they're like, oh, I hated it, but I would definitely don't regret it. I definitely would do it again. It's like, what? You just said you, you know. So to me, people put this thinking of their career as some chess match where you need to do 10 different moves, where if you have a good idea as to what you want to do, just directly go and do that thing. Don't create any interim steps in between
it. Love it. Awesome way to finish the interview, Nikki. And as Alex said, we certainly appreciate you coming on. We've been looking forward to this conversation. Not often we get to speak to those in the private market. So thank you for spending some time with us and speaking to the Equity Mates community today. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Equity Mates. We love hearing from you, so drop us a line at contact@equitymates.com, or even better, go to your podcast player and leave a 5-star review. Also, a reminder that the Equity Mates content train doesn't stop when you've run out of episodes to binge. We've got a brand new website, a Facebook discussion group. We're on Instagram, YouTube, and slowly making our way as an influencer on TikTok. Well, that's Ren. So come and say hello and join the community. We'd love to welcome you. Until next time.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian financial services license and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.